I want to thank the Soil Science Society of America, Agronomy Society, the Soil and Water Conservation Society for putting on this symposium. I would also like to mention that this presentation is a joint work by myself and a meteorologist, Dr. Smova, Dr. Uduara, who is in our agroforestry section, Dr. Anderson in soil physics, Dr. Miles, who's the curator of Sanborn Field, and an undergraduate student in atmospheric science. So, the issue is, why have long-term studies? And I went back to the Society's papers that were published back in 1991, The issue was sustainable production, soil quality, and soil health. These are the things that we're talking about now, 2015, and that was published in 1991. So we're still wrestling with increased production, but trying to maintain stability in our agriculture, not for today, not for 10 years from now, but for generations from now. And long-term studies are really essential because they provide the primary source of scientific knowledge that can then be used in models so that we can better make use of these resources and ensure sustainability. It's important that we've had a number of discussions where these long-term studies have shown the serendipitous impact of knowledge that wasn't even looked for. So instead of taking a look at disciplinary silos, it's going across and trying to understand how things happen in spite of the initial hypotheses that we're focused on. To manage biological diversity, we talked about the wonderful economic study in Iowa, taking a look at the profitability of rotations. Amazing. If you take a look at the maps from the 1930s to today, the diversity has decreased. Perhaps more work like was presented in the earlier performance will indicate that that we can still manage economic profits and still have a diverse system. So, recapping some of the talks that we had, long-term agricultural research, continuous cotton, plant diseases, BT hybrids, and in management of pests, and cropping systems. And what I want to talk about is soil quality and soil water. And my objectives are simply to talk about soil productivity and soil water, and measurement of soil water storage in a clay pan soil, the impacts of erosion on water storage in a clay pan soil, the impacts of climate on soil that has been altered by erosion, and then talk about conclusions. The very first erosion plots in the United States, nearly the first erosion plots in the world, were started at the University of Missouri in 1917 by M.F. Miller, and it provided the foundation in 1923 for the study of the conservation movement and indeed the universal soil loss erosion plots at the 23 erosion stations around the United States, and now everybody's talking about Russell II. The original erosional plots, which are still in existence at the University of Missouri, by 1930, the plots were so eroded that the intent was modified so that the study was focused on how can you restore these soils that have been so severely damaged. And so the study has been ongoing since 1930s. And the short story is, for our soils, for these clay pan soils, the restoration is not possible. there is a irrevocable loss of resources, the soils become inherently less productive. So here's a picture showing from these original erosion plots at the University of Missouri at these historic plots. Continuous corn, the average runoff, about 23%, about 30% of rainfall is runoff, and about 19 tons of soil loss per acre, time to erode a plow layer, 7 inches, 50 years. If you contrast that with a rotation, corn, wheat, clover rotation, the percent of runoff I think it's on.
Oh well. Does somebody have the other pointer that was up here?
No. Well, that's okay. The percent of runoff is 13%. The average erosion is 2%. The time to erode a 7-inch layer of soil is 360 years. And so, in the first century of farming, a foot of the topsoil was lost. And here's a picture of our profile. You've got this wonderful wind-blown silt loam soil that was produced from the bottoms of the Missouri River. And as the soil evolved, they're an alpha soil, as the soil evolved, the fines were deposited in the argillic horizon, and there's an increase in clay content from 20% in the topsoil that's uneroded to about 50%, maybe in some clay cases even 60% clay content in the subsoils. When that topsoil is lost, it is irreplaceable. So the objectives of my study are really to report the studies on the loss of this physical quality as a result of irreplaceable loss of available water from soil erosion on clay pan soils. And give you a perspective of the area of the United States that we're talking about. The area includes a large part of the Missouri crop-producing area in the north, the dark area, also some parts in Illinois, some parts in Kansas, Oklahoma, and some parts in Iowa. It turns out that some of the most productive area we have in our state is located in this area. This is this clay pan area. And it's relatively productive now, but with continued management, that productivity will significantly decrease. Here's a picture of the profile. Simply show you that in the subsoil, we've got this dark gray clay pan that develops as a result of pedogenesis. Hydrologically, you can kind of see that the surface soil, nice silt loam soil, almost what one might call an ideal soil, as one moves down through the profile, the soil becomes a tight clay, very low hydraulic conductivity, and significantly reduced water holding capacity. So Sanborn Field. Sanborn Field started as an accident in 1888. Basically, they put a number of these fields out. Really picturesque. It's a block away from our offices on campus, and it's currently going to have a celebration of 125 years of continuous operation. Here's a picture of the plots, again, not replicated. Dr. Miller had mentioned, we have continuous corn plots. Here's a continuous corn plot. Plot 17 has had no fertility added. Plot 18 has had 6 tons of farmyard manure added. We also have plots down here where we have continuous timothy. Continuous Timothy was actually the site where oreomycin was first discovered and was led to the production of the first antibiotics for World War II. It's currently used for treatment of animals, but basically it was the predecessor of the antibiotics. And I noticed in an article in Science magazine, a lot of microbiologists are now restudying soils to try to find out new antibiotic resistant to find new antibiotics to cope with the antibiotic resistant infections that we're getting. Yenny, who actually worked at the University of Missouri, was famous for coming up with his cross studies of organic matter and talking about the start of organic matter evolution up to warm grass, tall grass prairie, and then since cultivation begins, a significant decline. These results are from my an emeritus professor Wagner at the University of Missouri at Sanborn Field, showing the level of organic matter for the timothy, wheat, and corn plots, both with 6 tons of manure and with no treatment. And this would be the level that one might expect for 6 tons of manure with a timothy plot, which is essentially in a grass throughout the year, versus down here is a corn plot, corn with and corn without manure. Huge drop in organic matter. And this is plotting results from plot 6, which is continuous corn with a full fertility, added nitrogen, showing the period from 1915 to 1988, showing that about 6.65% organic matter was lost as a result of this cultivation. So my interest is available water. What does it do to available water? And I've taken the data that was published by Hudson in 1994, talking about soil organic matter and available water, and showing you that that decrease can cause, with a silt loam soil, a 2.6 decrease in change in available water, with 20% available water being, perhaps about as ideal as you can have. But the clay pan down here has significantly reduced water holding capacity. And here's this data from Diego Zortia in 1999, again showing soil organic matter versus yield. That's again, in a rain-fed condition, the amount of available water is directly related to the ability for that soil to produce plants. So how does climate affect corn yield in Missouri? And it's interesting, at least in Missouri, we're a water exporting state, and so the results of Hu and Bujanowski, published in the Applied Journal of Meteorology, is that climate effects can best be explained by within-season variation. And here you can kind of see, depending on a given year, yield can be significantly influenced. So the increased variability in weather is going to influence the yield, but it's more the within-year variation that's going to cause problems in yield. There's a big effort to produce a soil quality index. It's been the soil management assessment framework that's been developed by Carlin is really useful for talking about soil microbiological components. But as yet, there's been a struggle as to how to incorporate the change in available water into the soil management assessment framework, because it's considered, the amount of available water is too transitory to be useful. So perhaps, based on the long-term results of Stanburn Field, there's really a need to develop a soil quality index that includes the available water capacity of a soil into this soil quality soil management assessment framework. So what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to talk about how water is related to productivity in our case. And there was a paper produced in 1983 that talked about the soil productivity index. It went on in different developments called the EPIC model. And basically it said that the yield of a plant is related to climate and management, but primarily this potential available water holding capacity. And if you take and try to think about an ideal soil, the best soil you could possibly have would be 100% capable, and the sufficiency for available water would be maybe 20%. 20% available water would be an ideal soil. And as you decrease the amount of available water, its ability, its sufficiency becomes less and less sufficient. Here, if you have no available water, of course, not able to produce at all. So from Stanburn Field, taking a look at the amount of erosion that's occurred on plots that have been in continuous corn for 125 years, if you measure the change in available water, you can see that significant decrease from that 20%, which is near ideal, down to about 16%. And the sufficiency of available water near ideal down to about 70% available. So the question is then, and here's just simply showing the amount of topsoil left in these plots. Here's the amount of topsoil left in those corn plots. Half the topsoil compared to the amount of topsoil left in the Timothy plots, which had not been continuously plowed. And here's the clay content that I was talking about. Here, this big clay content, this bulge. Here's the unerroded plot, the red clover, and here's the plot. And what's happened is that we actually are now incorporating the clay into the surface soil, but reducing the available water of that silt loam soil. Again, showing you the more or less the same idea. Here's both the manured corn and the fertilized corn. Significantly reduced depth of silt loam soil compared to the six-year rotation. And the real fact is it reduces the available water. Huge reduction in the available water as a result of this loss of topsoil. So we published a paper in 1992, talking about, well, if we take a look at the depth of clay, how's that going to influence yield, either with irrigation or without irrigation? And it turns out that even if you try to add water to a soil that has had its available water capacity diminished, it's not possible to recover the potential. So it's getting the water through this clay becomes impossible because of the low hydraulic properties. And so you can see here, here's a selected crop information. And in terms of having a plot with zero topsoil, significantly reduced yield compared to having a plot with the normal topsoil, significantly reduced productivity. Now, my point is that in terms of management, if we're taking a look into the future, and if you go back to the map of Missouri and Iowa and Illinois and Kansas and Oklahoma that I showed, it is not going to be possible to restore this. This is a loss that is a permanent loss. So we went through and we came up with using Shaw's index for measuring the precipitation deficit, a regression to try to understand how rain-fed irrigation might be related to these soils that had been eroded, and we came up with a moisture stress index starting from Shaw up in Iowa State, and we have taken weather data from Sanborn Field from 1900 to 2015 for clay pan soils, and we compared the soil, the productivity from these, based on this 5-day weighted stress index across the clay pan index, clay pan area. And so what we've been able to find out here is here's our stress index for the 4.9, and here's our stress index for zero, and what it says is huge differences as a result of the amount of topsoil in terms of putting stress onto these plants and producing a water stress which will decrease yield. So my conclusion really is, in terms of long-term erosion plots, long-term sandborne field plots, is that conservation is possible. Montgomery published a really wonderful article in 2007 where he compared the amounts of soil erosion that's occurring from our current agricultural production. And then he said, well, what happens if we use some sort of conservation tillage? Maybe it's no tillage, maybe it's conservation tillage. You can actually get the level of soil erosion to be about equal to the level of soil formation simply by changing management practices, whether they're rotations or whether they're conservation tillage or have you. Also, that long-term conservation is possible with using alternative systems, especially in areas that are steep. Agroforestries are now providing a tremendous option in terms of developing sustainable agricultural systems. And you can see that my colleague, Dr. Udo Ottos, talked about the amount of sediment loss, the amount of percent reduction in sediment from agroforestry. It's 48%. And some of these crops are now being grown in Missouri. Nut crops are being used. Again, diversity and sustainability. So I'll end with a picture of Hugh Hammond Bennett. He came to Missouri, and my predecessor, Dr. Woodruff, apparently told the story that he took him on a ride from Bethany, Missouri, in a Model T Ford, and it had rained, and they were late to a meeting in Clarinda, Iowa, and Bennett said, "Stop the car," and he stopped the car, and he got out the running board of the Model T, and he took one shoe off, and took another shoe off, and took his socks off, and went out in the middle of the field, and got out and took the soil up, and he said, "Take a picture." And so that's where that picture's from. And the fact is that we're still losing unacceptable amounts of soil erosion, and coming up with long-term studies can show and demonstrate this, and coming up and showing the integration of diverse systems of agriculture can help create sustainable agriculture.
Thanks, Mark. We have time for a question or two for Clark. Sasha.
So the question I is, if I were to start an experiment today, such as Sanborn's Field, and how would I compare it to how they started Sanborn Field?
Yeah, what's the difference?
I think the experiment that we saw in California is an exceptional model. You understand that agriculture produced statistics as we know it today. People didn't understand replication. We have no replication, and although the evidence is so clear because the signals are so strong, having replicated plots is absolutely essential, And also, I would say, having plots of different scales. So we're talking about small scales and small plots, but having larger plots so that you can scale up. One of the major criticisms of the universal soil loss erosion plots is that they were 72 feet long. You said, well, that's not really measuring the amount of soil erosion. And so they've now gone to plots that are hundreds of meters long, trying to understand landscape scale effects. I think that those things are important. So having nested sets of experiments of different scales so you can see if the small scale also pertains to the large scale.
Any other questions, Clark? Excellent. Thanks, Clark. Just a couple of quick final things here. Our population over the course of the session has kind of gone up and down. But we had, just in case anybody's interested, we had about 85 individuals come through over the course. I was keeping track, noting everybody walking in and out. So that was a really nice attendance. Another response to your question, Sasha, since I have the podium, I think that during the poster session today, that you might find some posters and things dealing with some of the other long-term projects that are out there that may address your question. And that segues me into poster session 3:30 to 5:30. It's going to be posters 1511 to 1532 down in the exhibit hall. So hopefully we'll see you there. And thanks for coming and making it a great session, speakers and audience. Appreciate it.